Good evening. Welcome, everyone. Let's start the service with a song. Topic tonight is on technology, and so for a meditation, I'm going to be reading John 17, the whole chapter. These words spake Jesus, and lifted up his eyes to heaven, and said, Father, the hour is come. Glorify thy Son, that thy Son also may glorify thee. As thou hast given him power over all flesh, that he should give eternal life to as many as thou hast given him. And this is eternal life, that they might know thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom thou hast sent. I have glorified thee on the earth. I have finished the work which thou gavest me to do. And now, O Father, glorify thou me with thine own self, with the glory which I had with thee before the world was. I have manifested thy name unto the men which thou gavest me out of the world. Thine they were, and thou gavest them me, and they have kept thy word. Now they have known that all things whatsoever thou hast given me are of thee. For I have given unto them the words which thou gavest me, and they have received them, and have known surely that I came out from thee, and they have believed that thou didst send me. I pray for them. I pray not for the world, but for them which thou hast given me, for they are thine. And all mine are thine, and thine are mine, and I am glorified in them. And now I am no more in the world, but these are in the world. And I come to thee, Holy Father. Keep them through thine own name, those whom thou hast given me, that they may be one as we are. While I was with them in the world, I kept them in thy name. Those that thou gavest me I have kept, and none of them is lost, but the son of perdition, that the scripture might be fulfilled. And now come I to thee, and these things I speak in the world, that they might have my joy fulfilled in themselves. I have given them thy word, and the world hath hated them, because they are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. I pray not that thou shouldest take them out of the world, but that thou shouldest keep them from the evil. They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. Sanctify them through thy truth. Thy word is truth. As thou hast sent me into the world, even so have I also sent them into the world. And for their sakes I sanctify myself, that they also might be sanctified through the truth. Neither pray I for these alone, but for them also which shall believe on me through their word, that they all may be one, as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that thou hast sent me. And the glory which thou gavest me I have given them, that they may be one, even as we are one, I in them, and thou in me, that they may be made perfect in one, and that the world may know that thou hast sent me, and hast loved them as thou hast loved me. Father, I will that they also, whom thou hast given me, be with me where I am, that they may behold my glory which thou hast given me, for thou lovedst me before the foundation of the world. O righteous Father, the world hath not known thee, but I have known thee, and these have known that thou hast sent me. And I have declared unto them thy name, and will declare it, that the love wherewith thou hast loved me may be in them, and I in them. I want to point out, especially verse 15, it's the most well-known verse from this chapter. It's pretty often quoted. I pray not that thou shouldest take them out of the world, but that thou shouldest keep them from the evil. It seems one of the drawbacks of modern technology is that it does present a lot of temptations that that we just weren't quite as readily available before this technology became available. So I think that's one thing that Sanford will be addressing tonight in the topic. What are your prayer requests? I was asked to announce that there will be a snack after the service. provided by the girls in Miriam Awashige's Sunday school class.
Harold, could we actually reverse the lighting?
If you shut off the lights up there, that helps.
Oh, okay. I'm not thinking. There we go. I think we can probably have most of the auditorium lights on. At least it seemed to work well today. Anyway. Well, good evening. I made it. It's almost hard to believe. I was kind of running nervous today, wondering what is going to happen yet. But I have to admit, after, I'm not sure when it was one evening after I was home from the hospital, I was sitting there talking to Jolene, and I got to thinking about this, and I thought, you know, two times, things completely out of my control, and I went and I read the story of Balaam, and discovered that he was warned three times before he actually saw the angels. I was getting just a little concerned that I might have to have a serious conversation with the folks planning the midweek meeting, but I guess here we are, so we'll make the best of it. And I was kind of impressed. It's clear to me that you guys have some faith too, or you wouldn't be here tonight. This has kind of been a habit. But anyway, two things maybe before we dive into this. One, I'm going to be real honest with you. I'm not sure how to describe how I feel about having this topic. This has probably been one of the hardest topics that I've ever had to prepare for, which seems kind of backwards. But part of it, I think, is tonight especially, we want to look at the technologies that are out there. Just kind of look at what all is out there and kind of take a wide-eyed look at some of the things that are happening, have happened, might be coming down the pike. And so it might feel a little untheological tonight, but maybe a little more so the second night. The other thing I'm going to be very upfront with you about is somebody's going to raise their hand tonight to talk, and I'm going to look at you, and I'm not going to be able to say your name. Strangest thing, I'm not sure why, but I think it's connected to my surgery. Ever since I've had my surgery, I have the hardest time. I sat there tonight, I couldn't say Joe's name. I think it may be after effects of the anesthesia. I'm not sure. I don't know if anybody else has had a similar experience, but that is something I've had a real hard time with the last couple weeks. Well, anyway, this afternoon, I was talking with one of my employees about this subject of technology, and we were chasing some of the avenues that I might talk about. And one of the things I told him was that one of the things I'm really concerned about in this topic tonight is that when a guy like me, who is so involved in technology like I am, or in a given field, gets up front and talks, there's two things that can easily happen. One is that some people might say, he's just so buried in his field that he's got tunnel vision, so really can't trust what he says, so you just kind of throw out what the guy is saying. The other group of people might trust me too much because of the field that I work in, and just swallow everything I said. And I said, you know, about 40% of the people might just swallow what I say, and the other 40% might throw it out. And he said, well, that leaves another 20%. What are they going to do? And I said, well, by the time the evening's over, they'll be asleep. So hopefully it won't be too terribly boring. When you think of where we are at today with technology and all the things that have developed over the last 50, 100 years, there was one verse that repeatedly came to my mind as I thought about this, and I don't know if there's any specific verse you think of, and I debated putting this verse at the beginning of the topic or at the end, and finally decided I think I'll put it at the beginning because it does, I think, help to frame some of our thinking. Going back to what I was saying just a little bit ago, one of my biggest concerns tonight, as we look at technology and maybe a second evening as we talk about it and think about it, I don't want you to just like I said, just swallow what I say because that's the field I work in, or hopefully not just throw it out because that's the field I work in. But I hope that this can be a forum to get us to think carefully. I want you to think on your own about these things that we're going to be talking about tonight, especially because we come from a culture where a lot of us come from a church background where technologies and some of these ideas have been pretty legislated in the past. If there was something that the church was concerned about, we just said no to it. If you buy a vehicle, I remember the days when, where I grew up in church, you painted your vehicle black. If it came with a stereo, you pulled it because it had a radio in it. And you could go on down that list, and there's a lot of those things that we don't do anymore. And one of the things that's happening because of the way technologies work is lines get crossed. Where things were once very clearly defined, maybe a device had one specific function, it's just not that way anymore. And I think probably largely as a result of that, we no longer simply really take a given piece of technology and say, we are not going to use this. And coming full circle on what I was saying earlier, this is why I want us to think carefully about these things, because the church no longer does your thinking for you. Does that make sense? I'd like to kind of lay that out there as we go through some of this stuff. Some of the stuff we're going to look at tonight might feel a little boring. But one thing I wanted to do was to, especially with this verse as a backdrop, give us all a feel for how the world has changed, especially in the last 100 years. If you look at the history of inventions and some of the things that have developed in the world, there's a ton of things we could look at. I picked out just a few things that I thought were especially what we call game-changing things that change the geopolitical landscape, that change how societies work and function. The chariot, the wheel, was probably the first invention, piece of technology, if you will. We don't often think of these kinds of things as technology, but they were some of the things that began to change how the world worked. Iron was also discovered apparently about at the same time. I noted with interest that even though it mentions iron in the Bible very early on, we don't read much about that until quite a bit later, when iron and brass were used as Goliath's weaponry and as his shielding. And it's interesting, if you read the story, this was a huge problem for the Israelites. This was something that really changed the playing field, because you couldn't go up against a guy with a steel sword and spear if you're using something made out of wood. It just doesn't work so well. 800 BC, I thought this was interesting. This giant sundial is 27 meters tall. It's what, about close to 100 feet tall. What you see there is really just the very tip of the sundial. Learning how to track time and track the sun. Glass was discovered around 500 BC. I don't know, how many of you have ever been somewhere like Sturgeon Glass in Hutchinson? I don't know if you've noticed how they use glass in there. It's kind of interesting, some of the things that you can do with glass. I thought this picture was interesting. I think I would feel just a little nervous walking up a staircase that's made out of glass. I've already walked out over a platform that's made out of glass, and it's a little disconcerting to be able to simply look right down through the floor and see what's underneath you. Again, another kind of a game-changing device. If you had a catapult and the enemy didn't, you could stand back where they couldn't hit you, and you could hit them. And that really changes the scene. And it's interesting, especially today, it seems like a lot of the beginnings of the technologies that are developed today often find their roots in an organization named DARPA. I don't know if that name means anything to you or not, but it's, I can't even say what it stands for, defense something or other research program, I'm not sure, but interesting that a lot of times some of this stuff finds its roots in being connected to the military. By the way, if you have questions, don't hesitate to stop me, because I'm going to be moving pretty rapidly through some of this. Go ahead, Gary.
Makes me think also of the space program.
Yes.
Federally funded programs sometimes are on the cutting edge of research in these fields.
Exactly. Marvin. Interesting. Do you remember the verse?
No, but it's interesting. The well, the power beam looks at the truth for you, and something like that. In the past couple of weeks, been something about technology, and I
will readily admit, a bunch of this stuff I pulled from Wikipedia, and I tried to cross-reference as much as I could. So. Hey, I wasn't there at 400 BC, so it wouldn't surprise me a bit if I was off. Dwight.
I think the Bible calls it engines of war.
Uh-huh.
I think that was close to the time of Hezekiah.
Yes. That's ringing a bell. Do you have it, Oren?
I'm trying to get my eyes on it. I think it's the King of God, but I'm not quite sure. Still haven't found
it. Interesting. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense that it could have very well been something on this order. What's the big deal with a horseshoe? This was one of the things I ran across as I studied. And as I thought about it, I realized, can you imagine the impact that it had on travel once you could actually shoe a horse and didn't have problems with wearing the hooves off, getting stones stuck in? I don't know what all those issues are. Once you can shoe a horse, that really changes travel. Probably one of the biggest changes between the time of the chariot and some of the things that came later. Anyway, thought it was interesting. Now we jump up to AD 800. There wasn't a whole lot that seems to have been developed in about a 1,000-year time span there, maybe a little bit more. Gunpowder, again, changed the face of war and was used for other things as well. Here's where it starts to really get interesting. I was very fascinated by some of the things that I read about the Gutenberg Press. One of the things that I found out was that there were other Chinese presses and other Eastern presses that were used prior to the Gutenberg Press, but it was the Gutenberg Press that really kind of turned things loose in terms of mass printing. His approach was just a little different. He used movable type. That really wasn't superseded until the advent of what's called offset printing. I'm curious, how many of you remember going to school and seeing what they call it, a mimeograph machine being used? Do you remember that? Where you run the hand crank? I remember one of those from my very first years in school. I'm not sure how long they used it, but I think maybe my first 2 or 3 years they actually had a mimeograph machine that was still in use. Yes, David. Exactly. Up till the time of the Gutenberg Press, information really was just not readily available. Everything pretty well had to be word of mouth. I noted with interest, if you look at the first section here, by 1424, there were only 122 books in the Cambridge University Library, and each one of them was worth about the value of a small farm. Can you imagine how many books are in the Hutchinson Library or in your house? We have way more than 122 books in our house. that really, really changes things. And I think, like David said, I think the press was, in a very large sense, responsible for beginning to change that kind of veil of darkness that had covered society up to that point. Somebody tell me, what was the first book that was printed with the Gutenberg Press? Bible. I noted with interest that today they've determined, if my memory serves me right on the numbers, there was a total of 144 Bibles printed on the Gutenberg Press, 48 of which are still in existence today. I think that's pretty impressive, one-third of them, 400 or 500 years later. Today there's a website, Gutenberg.org. I don't know if you've ever been out there and taken a look at what they're doing or not, but every week that website gives away over 3 million e-books, electronic books that you can read on a computer or a similar device. Huge change from what we started with back in the 1300s and 1400s. There's lots of free books available out there that you can download. One of the next things that happened, it says the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Remember studying about the Industrial Revolution and all the things that went into that. There was a lot of changes in the textile industry because of the development of the heat engine. I think the development of the heat engine was probably really the first time where you could get work done without having to use your own elbow grease to get it done. I've often wondered what those times looked like. That was a huge game changer in terms of how things were done and the costs of getting those things done in terms of manpower. Yes. Early to mid 1800s, I think. Let me go to the next slide here. I guess I don't have those dates. But yeah, the late 18th and early 19th century, I guess late 1800s was when that really began to be used. There was stuff earlier than that, but it didn't really develop to where it was used in an industrial sense until the late 1800s. Marvin, were you going to say something? I hadn't even thought of that. Excellent. Yeah. And there's a lot of power available in water power if it's used right. Probably, as I think about that, though, I think one of the things that this changed was you weren't restricted to a given locality. You could go do things wherever you wanted to. I'm curious, I don't know, is there anybody here who remembers threshing wheat or doing something like that with one of these steam tractors? Really? Wow. That's interesting. Interesting. You've seen a lot of changes in your day. Amos. How many of you saw that steam engine that stopped out here in Hutchinson, I don't know, a year or two ago? There was a bunch of you. Good. I was very surprised. I got to talk with one of the engineers, and did you walk up beside the engine? I actually saw it out here in Hutchinson, and one of the things that amazed me was how big that thing was when I walked up beside it. I think the main drive wheels were like 8 feet tall. And I asked one of the engineers how fast they go and how much horsepower that thing produces. And he said, oh, they'll go as fast as the speed limit allows on the track. And I said, well, how fast is that? And he said, well, out west in some places it's 80 miles an hour. And they'll run 80 miles an hour. And I said, well, how much horsepower does this thing produce? And I thought, you know, maybe 1,000 horsepower. I didn't know. And he said 5,000 or a little better. I had no idea. Something else interesting that he told me was that steam engines are still in use in some of the mountains, some of the mountainous areas down in South America, because the steam engine, by virtue of how steam works, actually works better at higher elevations than lower elevations. Water boils easier, so you can produce more power at higher elevations, which is the exact opposite of a diesel electric. And so they actually still use them in some of those places. Thought that was interesting. Late 1800s, this is where things really started to get interesting. We're moving away from steam power and moving toward what we call the internal combustion engine. This will look very familiar to some of you who've had a motor apart. First time I took a motor apart and learned how it worked was, I don't know, I was probably about 16 or 17 in high school. Very fascinating. If you know how a single-cylinder motor works, you know how a 10-cylinder motor works. It's just the same thing done more times. This is where power really started to become mobile. Up to this time, you know, we had these big, heavy steam tractors. One of the drawbacks of steam, I don't know if you ever read any of these stories or not, but one of the drawbacks of steam was it could be very dangerous. If a steam engine blew up, it was not a pretty thing. I remember in Pennsylvania, one of my friends read a story about a steam engine that was used to pull coal out of haul coal down the mountain out of one of the coal mines, and one day that thing blew up. And I think this was probably about 100 years ago, 75 to 100 years ago. And he went up on the mountains. He actually found a piece of that engine about a quarter mile away on the other side of the next mountain that had actually blown over there from that explosion. Pretty serious stuff. So this was a pretty important development, because this is really pretty safe stuff. The other thing that changes here is that what's called the horsepower to weight ratio really changes. You can use a much smaller engine with a lot more power, and that allows you to do creative new things that you just couldn't do before. About the same time, you have Thomas Edison, another well-known name, working with electricity and light. Some of the very, very first steps in learning how to use electric. And we obviously benefit from that today. You imagine meeting tonight with kerosene lamps, those kinds of things, really changes things. Here's where the fun really starts. Early 1900s. I had to put this in here because this is one of the biggest changes in terms of how we travel. Remember that verse? People are going to run to and fro. And this is, I think, one of the early steps of very, very visible fulfillment of that prophecy. 1903 really isn't that long ago when you stop and think about it. In the course of the history of the world, that's what, 105 years ago? There's people that were living, might even be living yet, who remember this era. Now, here's where I'm going to change just a little bit, and I want to show you just a little bit of how things have changed from 1903 to today. Because we've looked at, you know, from 3000 BC to up to about 1900, and things are changing very slowly, a period of 5,000-6,000 years. In the last 100 years, though, this, especially since the development of the engine, the discovery of electricity, a couple of these things, people have begun building on these things and putting them together in creative new ways, and today we see the offshoots of that. Late last year, I think it was October or November of 07, their Airbus released a new airplane called the A380. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that or have seen that or seen the pictures. It's bigger than the 747, way cooler if you look at the pictures. I'm going to show you a few things just to kind of underscore how things have changed in the last 100 years and to give you a little bit of a picture, not just of how they've changed in the last 100 years, but what's the next, if the world stands, what would the next 100 years possibly look like? And that's part of what we want to talk about. 555 people can be comfortably seated on this A380. 569 tons maximum takeoff weight. That's about the equivalent of 14 fully loaded semis, and it flies. I mean, can you imagine what the Wright brothers would say if they could see this? I often wonder. Cruise speed of about 580 miles an hour and over 34,000 gallons of fuel in 10 tanks. That's a lot of stuff. Here's a picture on Singapore Airlines received the first one, and on its first flight, they sold tickets for the first flight on this airplane, $10,000 a ticket, 450-some seats. They sold out immediately, and all the money went to a charitable organization. Thought it was an interesting publicity stunt. $10,000 a seat. Now, here's why. Take a look at the inside of this thing. This is not your normal coach class where your knees are jammed against the seat in front of you. You know what it's like. If you've flown, you've been there. This is the stairway going from the second level to the first level. And we're not going to see near all of it, but we're talking about an airplane. Remember, this is not a ship. This is an airplane. You can have your own private room if you want to, and if you've got the money. This is coach class on this airplane. Doesn't look like the coach class that I know so well. Business class. This guy's sitting in a business class seat. I think he's got a little room to grow. Have any of you flown business class? I mean, this just totally trumps anything I've ever seen. Oops, happened to hit it twice. That's what you can do with that business class seat. Just lay down and go to sleep. Try that on any airplane that I've flown on. You can't do that. But it kind of underscores where how things have changed. I mean, from barely being able to get an airplane off the ground 105 years ago, to flying something that weighs almost 600 tons and holds 555 people, people are going to run to and fro, and knowledge will be increased. We'll keep coming back to that. Now let's jump forward to, and I'm kind of skipping some things here. One of the things I thought about that I realized I'm skipping is we're not really looking at the automotive industry. And how that changed things. That's also very much a part of that discussion. And I think that's probably an area that we're more familiar with than some of the others. Gary?
And the railroad.
Yes.
I remember in 1960 that there were multiple passenger trains that went on these tracks per day. You know, I someone else could tell us how many, but it was they were not just at nighttime, once a day kind of event.
Interesting. Now we're kind of jumping into the start of what you might call the computing world. In the early 40s, and I think even prior to that, there were some developments, and there's arguments about who really had the first computer and which one it actually was. I think what's called the ENIAC is probably one of the most credited as really being the first computer that was really used as a computer is used today. The first computers didn't have the electronic technology that we have today. They ran on vacuum tubes. They were very large. Note here that it says it covered 1,800 square feet. I'm not sure what the size of this room is, but probably would have pretty well filled up this room. Weighed 30 tons and took 160 kWs of power to run it. That's a lot of power. The biggest thing to note about that is at that point, that machine was about 1,000 times faster than anything that had been developed prior to that, any of the calculating machines that they had. A lot of physical connections. Somebody tell me, where did the word bug come from? Or the term bug in terms of computing technology? Has anybody heard that story? Joel? It was shorting the connections, yeah. And that's kind of where that term bug came from. They literally had bugs getting stuck in the computer and causing problems. This picture here gives you a little bit of an idea of what the outside of this thing looks like. One of the comments, I don't remember who said it, but somebody in this era commented that it just doesn't see the need for the world to have more than about 5 computers. It was all the world was ever going to need. We'll talk about that a little bit later, about how many computers that the world has. The first generation of computers used vacuum tubes. The second one used transistors. And a transistor, I don't know how familiar you are with how electronics work, but a transistor is a little device that's basically just a little switching device that can be used to make very simple yes-no decisions. The third generation used integrated circuits, and then the fourth generation used microprocessors. All of these things were building on the things that had been discovered and learned before. Probably the single biggest thing that came out of this was that transistors really changed the design of electronics and computers, because it really shrunk the space that was required to build one of these machines. By comparison, the phone on my belt has, I don't know how many more times calculating power than that first ENIAC did, and it runs on a battery. And depending on how I use it, you know, I'll get a full day's use out of it. Make a lot of calls, read email, do that kind of thing. And now I can actually carry it on my belt. No 30 tons or 160 kW of power. The processor that runs on this phone, or runs this phone, is what is called an ARM processor. It's made by Intel. And when I was out on Intel's website today doing a little research, I was trying to find out how many transistors are actually in this processor. I couldn't find that number anywhere. I thought that was kind of odd. But I thought it was interesting. Recognize some of the names of these companies. These are companies that Intel is partnering with who are using the same kind of microprocessor that I have in this phone. And you probably have them either in a phone or a device that you're using. You'll see a lot of familiar names there. And it's important. It doesn't seem like that big a deal until you think about it, that a lot of this stuff has really developed in the last about 20 years. A pile of devices that uses processors, again, uses these ARM processors like what's in this phone. You've got phones on there, BlackBerries, hard drives, cameras, digital cameras, printers. I'm not sure what all's on there. Some little handheld devices, flip phones, GPS units, some of those kinds of things. Now, we'll go back to kind of the beginning of the computer. I don't know how many of you remember this era of the computer. My first computer was a Packard Bell 8088. I still have it. It actually got sold to, I think Harry Schenck bought it, and then I think it was given to Myron Bontrager. And somehow I found out where it went, and I went and got it back, and it still works. That's the impressive thing. 20 years later, the thing actually turns on and boots up and runs the menus that I wrote 20 years ago. It's kind of hard to believe. Anyway, fun stuff. So 81, we're looking at about 20, 25 years ago. I don't know how many of you used a computer in that era, but if you did, you remember that everything was what we called command line. You had to type in a command, a number, or a command to make the computer do something. You couldn't grab a mouse and go click on things. Well, Microsoft released its first version of Windows around 85, and things developed pretty rapidly from there. Today, you sit down and use a computer with a mouse and keyboard, probably the most common input devices. You can actually use voice input to control a computer if you really want to. I have a friend who uses a voice program to do a lot of voice dictation to write out notes instead of actually typing it. We've got about 10 minutes left. Here's where we'll probably start changing just a little bit from all this stuff that's out there. Actually, I think I've got another slide or two. I had a real hard time knowing how to organize these last slides, because I wasn't sure what we're going to have time for tonight. Some of the common computer uses. Are there other things that you think of that aren't on this list that we should maybe talk about, just to throw out there to think about? So these are just some of the most common ones: word processing, you know, line of business applications, accounting, communications. You have email. web access. A couple of things we might talk about later, things like chatting, instant messaging. I don't know if you're all familiar. Is there anybody who doesn't know what instant messaging is on a computer? Okay. How about using VoIP or a program like Skype? You familiar with making a phone call over a computer? Do you know you can do that? Wow. Everybody seems to be aware. Not necessarily? Okay. In the simplest terms, you know, it used to be you picked up a phone, made a phone call, and you paid Ma Bell 30 cents a minute or whatever they were charging. Well, one of the things that's been happening is as computer networks are more and more connected, we have what we call the internet, kind of spanning the globe, they've learned how to take real-time audio and compress it and send it across a computer network using completely different technology than the analog technology that's historically been used to do phone communication. It's digitized and sent down the wire. In the very earliest stages, really wasn't very good. You talk to somebody who was using a program like Skype or some other VoIP program, and they sounded hollow and teeny, and the connection was poor and it'd break. But the reason why this is so interesting and why people are pursuing this is because the cost is so drastically different if you do it across a computer network. It costs to do that compared to doing a voice call over a normal phone line. Maybe to back up a little bit to help explain some of the differences, I don't know how many years ago, probably, I don't know, 50 years ago? How long has it been since party lines died?
I think it's quite that long.
30 to 50 years, maybe? Maybe not even that much. Marvin's shaking his head. Go ahead. I see. Jared.
Well, this is maybe a side note, but I think it ties in with what you're talking about with the computer's internet. One of the things that I think has transformed a lot of this as well, and I was wanting to ask Mom if I was remembering right, but NASA, I think, celebrated their 100th anniversary. Is that today? I think it is. But
interesting. We'll probably talk a little bit more about some of that later, too. The biggest, when we talk about changing cost in how a phone conversation works, today the phone networks are very different from what they were, say, 30 to 50 years ago. At one point, you had to have a phone operator sitting in a central office somewhere, and you'd call in, okay, you want to talk to so-and-so, and she had to take a jumper wire and plug it into your port and connect your port to the people's port that you wanted to call, and then the two of you could talk. Well, they got smarter about that, and as some of this stuff developed, they figured out how to make switches that handle that kind of stuff automatically. But the drawback in that design is that you are still only using one wire from person A to person B, and you're tying up that whole wire. Nobody else can use that wire. Well, on a computer network, it's very different. If you compress these audio feeds, you can have many people using the same wire at the same time, and it really changes the cost because it can all be automated. That's what's driving some of that, and we'll probably come back to some of that a little later on. We'll talk a little bit about computers. I'd like to talk a little bit about cell phones and some other gadgets then a little bit, and then we'll probably have to wrap this up. Some issues. What are some common problems? There's benefits to using PCs. There's also some common problems. Some of the most common ones that we see in our shop, we have a lot of people who bring in computers who are infected with bad programs that do something that the user doesn't want it to do. And there's a huge laundry list of things that they might do. One of the things that happens is, let me back up a little bit. There's a lot of people out there who are using the internet, and they're surfing websites, looking up information, doing very legitimate things. It used to be that if you simply stayed on what we would call reputable websites, businesses that had real websites providing real services that were important, you were okay. You didn't run into any problems. One of the things that we're seeing happening is there are companies like Google and Yahoo. You're familiar with those names? They're internet companies that provide service, searches, news, email services, a lot of things like that. What's happening is there are people out there who are going to these companies, and these companies make a lot of money off of selling advertising through other people's websites. And so they go to these companies and they buy advertising for their programs, their malware, their programs that try to get you to do something that you maybe don't want to do, spend money on something you don't want to spend it on. And they actually buy legitimate advertising that gets placed on legitimate companies' websites. But it's promoting their malware. One of the things that we see is, especially programs that you go to this website and this advertisement pops up and it looks like a real program. It's not. It's actually a pop-up advertisement, and it tells you that, oh, you have viruses on your computer, or you have something wrong with your computer, or something wrong with the registry, and you need to do this to fix it now before you have problems. And, oh, by the way, give us $19.99 and we'll fix the problem for you. And a lot of people spend the $19.99 and buy this software only to find out that the problem is now worse. They've actually been socially engineered into clicking on things and installing something on the computer that they really don't want and actually just makes the problem worse. We see a lot of that. It's kind of interesting. A lot of what we call social engineering going on. They get you to do things that you wouldn't do otherwise if you actually knew what was going on. Something else that happens a lot, there's a kind of a new term that's developed in the last couple of years called phishing, where maybe you get an email that tells you that there's been a problem with your bank account and you need to go out and log into your bank's website and update your username and password, because if you don't, they're going to lock your account because there's been some kind of security problem. Well, if you click on the link, it takes you out to a website that looks like your bank's website, but it's not. They get your username and password. That's not good. Now they have access to your bank account, and believe me, they will clean it out. It does happen. So that's where that term phishing comes from. That's one of the things that's going on. Something else that I wanted to talk about a little bit, too, in regards to computer usage is there is this idea, very mistaken, I think, conception that when you are using the internet that you're completely anonymous. Without going into a lot of the technical details about how this works, there's actually a lot of information that is tracked when you use the internet. When you go to websites, you leave tracks all over the place. Your computer, in order to use a network like the internet, has to have what's called an IP address. And that IP address is often logged and documented on the websites that you visit. There's a lot of things that actually happen on the computer itself, too, that track where you go, and a lot of the common cleanup tools don't clean up those tracks. They're still there. Deleting files is another thing I wanted to talk about that I think is a common misconception among people who routinely use computers. There's this idea if you delete a file on the computer that it's gone. It's not actually. What the computer actually does when you delete a file is it has a kind of an index of where all the files are out there on the hard drive. And when you tell it to delete a file, it doesn't go delete the file. It just deletes the record from the index, and it leaves the file sitting out there on the hard drive. And there's times when we have people who come in and they've had a problem with a computer. Maybe they've lost personal data, and we'll go get those files back. And in most cases, I don't know what the percentage is, probably 90% or better, we can actually get the files back that have been lost or deleted either unintentionally or maybe through a problem with a computer. part of why I'm kind of underscoring this is to say, be careful when you sell an old computer or give it away or send it to the landfill or do something like that. If you have personal data, especially banking data, confidential data, that you don't want out in the public hands, make sure that that hard drive is properly destroyed. If it's not worth much, something like a hammer and a drill will do a good job at ensuring that nobody gets the data off of that hard drive. And there's other ways too, but that's the easiest thing if it's not worth much. And you read the stories in the news about things that get out. That's one of the ways that that happens. Something else I wanted to talk about, and I see I'm rapidly running out of time. We've talked a little bit about PCs. I want to talk a little bit about the whole world of music, because I think that is especially pertinent with some of the developments that have taken place in the last 20 years. How many of you have heard the term MP3? You know what an MP3 file is? Not necessarily everybody. Just in a nutshell, I'm sure everybody knows what a CD is. It's the most current, easily used music format that's out there. If you take a CD and you look at the amount of storage space on that CD, the average CD holds about 75 minutes of music, about 700 megabytes of information. You can get about 12 to 15 songs on, depending on the average song length. About 20 years ago, there was a German company that developed a file format called the MP3 format. And essentially what they did is they figured out how to take a five-minute song that might be 100 megabytes in size and compress it down to about one-tenth of the original size without actually losing any serious audio quality. Now, there's some loss. I mean, if you have really good hearing, you can hear the difference. I'm sure somebody like Lyle can probably pick out whether it's CD quality or not. But what it did, and this is something I really want to focus on, may have to in the next evening because we're just out of time, but when you take information, whatever that information is, and you figure out ways to shrink the space that is required to store that information, it becomes very game-changing in that field. And what's happened as a result of this is instead of having a stack of 100 CDs at home, you can now take those CDs, convert them to MP3 format, and load all of that music on one single portable music device and take it with you. And you see people with an iPod or some other MP3 player in their pocket. Apple Computer has been especially good at addressing this market. The iPod is probably the most popular music player out there. I've got one sitting in my truck. I use it all the time. It's great. It makes it very easy to take audio files wherever you want. Here's what's impressive. Current iPod, about 80 gigs of space on the hard drive, if that means anything to you. If you do the math, you can put about 16,000 songs on that hard drive. Now, I don't have anywhere close to 16,000 songs, but what's important about this is, like one person that I listened to recently observed, if you can't take all of your audio with you, it's kind of meaningless. Because which chunk of your audio do you want to leave at home? Now, for myself, I have my music on there, but what I use it for more is to listen to what's called a podcast. Some of you may be familiar with that term. There are guys who are working in the field of technology all the time who know a lot more than I do about this stuff, and there are weekly discussions about what's going on, and it's very educational. And so I'll download these and listen to them when I'm driving to and from work, mornings and evenings. Very handy. There's kind of a laundry list of gadgets we could talk about. Some of the things I thought about were GPS devices. Very handy. There's a lot of data stored on those. You see people walking around with these little Bluetooth headsets that they use to talk on their cell phone. There's digital cameras, cell phones, and smartphones. Smartphones is something I want to come back to and talk about later on. One of the things that you start to see with all of these technologies is that people keep figuring out new and creative and different ways to put different pieces together and do things either in a different way or a new way. One of the most interesting things that I saw was kind of a melding of internet technologies, inventory technologies and RFID technologies. Are you familiar with the term RFID? RFID just stands for radio frequency identifier. Everybody knows who Walmart is. RFID chips are really just a very minimal piece of electronic technology. It's just a little chip that can be extremely cheaply produced, and it can be stuck on something or in something. And when it is read with a scanner, it simply responds essentially with a, yes, I'm here, and this is who I am. Just a simple little code. What's interesting about this is it is allowing companies with huge distribution systems like Walmart, Target, any of those companies out there that deal with a lot of inventory, and large manufacturing operations is another area where this is being used. It allows them to track their inventory real time in ways that you just couldn't possibly do if you had to rely on humans to do it. Because as this stuff comes down a conveyor belt, it can be tracked in the computer system, and you know exactly where that order is, whether or not it's halfway through the assembly process, is there a part that's missing? There's all kinds of creative ways that is used to be able to track stuff. And you take this all the way to the end of where this can go, and they actually have refrigerators out there. You can set up your fridge and tell it to monitor, do I have milk in the fridge? Do I have cheese in the fridge? Is the milk 4 days old, 5 days old? Should I replace the milk? Is there Pepsi in the fridge? All these kinds of things. And you can have it monitor that stuff. And when you run out of something, automatically place an order to your grocer and have it delivered to your house. That's where some of this stuff is winding up. Granted, it'll probably be a while before some of us see some of those kinds of things, but it's actually out there. Brent, go ahead.
They're using that for livestock as well.
For tracking livestock?
Yeah, because of this
known source. Known sourcing on meat. Exactly. Excellent example. Marvin.
Well, some of us have those embedded in our credit cards, too. I know I do.
Interesting. And that's something that I think we're going to see more and more of this, what we call embedded technologies. Things that you don't see, but they're there, and they have a very simple job to do. And for the most part, pretty benign, very useful in a lot of ways. But there's also a flip side to that picture, and I want to talk about some of that. The last phrase here on this slide is bandwidth, bandwidth, bandwidth. And if I can explain it in two minutes, why this is so important to this discussion. If you, some of you understand what I mean by bandwidth, but for the sake of those of you who don't, if you go water your garden, you're going to use a garden hose, right? It's about a half inch in diameter, and you get 5 gallons a minute, or somewhere thereabouts out of this garden hose, and you get your garden watered. But if you go out and you want to water a 160-acre quarter section, you're going to use a big irrigation pump with a 5 or 6 or 8 inch irrigation pipe, and you're going to run a lot more water through that distribution system. That's the same idea as what we call bandwidth when we talk about moving data across a wire. In the history of the development of things like the internet, computer networks, phone technologies, especially, we'll especially talk about cell phones and smartphones maybe in the next session. But as the available data pipe grows, 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, most of us who had an internet connection were on a dial-up connection. It's very slow. It runs across the phone line, and you get 3 to 5K of data transfer across that wire. Today, at my shop, I can go on the internet and download a file from a tech support website, and I can download, on average, one of the last ones I did was a 20 meg file. It takes about 20 seconds. Well, across a dial-up connection, that would take about 20 to 24 hours. provided that your connection didn't break in that time period, which was very frustrating. If you've been there, you know what that's like. Some of the things that we're going to need to talk about, I think, as a church and as a group of people who are concerned about the things we use, are going to be driven by the fact that as bandwidth changes, as these data pipes grow, more and more things become available across those pipes, things that we have real reservations and questions about. This afternoon, as I was talking with my employee, I was sitting there and I said, you know, the time is coming when you're going to be able to watch anything you want on TV on your cell phone, on this little screen. And he laughed at me and pulled out his cell phone and hit a few buttons and pulled up his screen and was watching TV. What do I know? You know, it's kind of funny. I'm in the field and I still get behind. The clock. Cell phones, lots of uses. And here I should switch gears a little bit. And thinking about next Wednesday evening, think especially about how we use some of these things, both positively and some of the negative ramifications. I really wanted to talk a little bit about our email and our digital communications. Again, we have this illusion of privacy. I send an email to you, you and me are the only people who read it. There's very real evidence, and I have a document here I wish I had time to read. If you've been watching the news, especially since about the middle of last year, how many of you are aware of the lawsuit against AT&T by the EFF? Interesting. Something well worth thinking about. I grew up studying our economic system and our form of capitalism and really grew up trusting our government. Today, there are indications that our government really is no more trustworthy than some of the other governments of the world that we really distrust. I would encourage you to go out and read up on some of these issues. We are being watched in ways that I think would make most of us pretty uncomfortable if we were directly aware of what's going on. More on that later. These are two verses that I wanted to reference at the end of the evening. While the world is changing in some ways, don't the root problems really stay the same? We have all these technologies that we've just kind of roared across tonight, but a lot of these things, I think, really don't do anything more than show us what we're really made of, who we really are. Whether a person is good or bad, evil men and seducers will wax worse and worse, and I think that is something that we're seeing today. But as I sat up here tonight and listened to some of the songs we sang, isn't it refreshing to realize that the work that Jesus Christ did 2,000 years ago is just as real and just as relevant today as it was then? In a world that looks completely different from what it was 2,000 years ago, our needs and our problems are really still the same, and the solution is still the same, and it hasn't changed one bit. This was an interesting comment that I was chatting with the branch manager at the Hutchinson Credit Union yesterday, and she made this comment. I thought it was worth repeating. Just something to think about as you think about the topic next week. A couple of questions that I'd like to throw out there for next week. Some things to think about to stir your thinking. And if you have questions you'd like to have discussed next week, I would enjoy having you bring them to me so we can for sure cover them. But I'd like next week to especially focus on how do these things and our uses of them affect how we view each other, how we relate to each other, and how we view the world around us. My wife made an interesting comment. We were talking a little bit about our dating relationship. I don't know how many of you are aware of where I was during our dating relationship, but most of the time I was in Central America, and most of our relationship was built on handwritten letters. There were a few phone calls, not many. At a buck and a half a minute, you don't tend to make very many of those. But I thought it was interesting. She commented that she's glad that we didn't have email and text messaging at that point. Read one case today, 14-year-old boy. In 1 month, ran up $657 of text messaging charges on a cell phone, 12,000 text messages. Do the math. 16 hours a day, 30 days in a month. That's a text message every 2 minutes. There is a lot of that going on out there. A lot. I'm sorry to keep you this late. Ollie.
And with an allowance of $10 a month, in Canada, there was no phone calls. And we appreciate it.
Ollie just touched just a little bit on something I want you to think about, too. Think about, as you think about how we relate, how we develop relationships and maintain those relationships, is it possible to really develop close personal relationships without FaceTime? Can you do it through things like email, text messaging, etc.? Think about your experiences in those mediums and who your close friends are today. And we'll talk about some of those things next week. And think about the value that is placed on different forms of communication. When somebody sends you something, what's the premium that you place on that message? Is that connected to how you get that message? Think about some of those things. Well, thanks for your attention. I hope I haven't bored you. And again, going back to what I said at the beginning, think about, I want you to think carefully about these things, because we're talking about these things because they're not things that are just sliced and diced easily for us today in a world where technologies are completely separate. We need to learn to think very carefully as individuals and as a group about how we approach these things, because they are important. Maybe we'll forego the song. Shall we just stand? And Josh, would you close with prayer? Let's pray.